Welcome to CyberFix, your dopamine-infused tech news update. My name is Gabriel, here to help get other information junkies up to speed with important tech news. Stay tuned for a lighthearted exploration of hostile cyberspace and what we can do about it. This is episode 7, being recorded on September 21st, 2024, and we'll be discussing, no joke, exploding pagers and radios, digital blunders, a solutions roundup, then a short break, some tech news, pre-crime roundup, and control grid updates. The music credits for this episode are YNV Loon, Valkos A New Light, Killer Cats Kaibu, Asphyxia, and Jim Yosef Everlasting The NCS Release. Starting out with no joke, exploding pagers and radios. There was a series of cyber physical attacks in Lebanon where originally pagers, but then walkie-talkies blew up in a series of explosions. These explosions were caught on video, so many people were speculating about how this could have happened. One of the biggest questions that people immediately jumped to was, could this happen to any smartphone? And this was something that 404 Media did a great job kind of jumping to answer, where based off the footage alone, you would see that lithium ion battery fires are very different than the nature of these explosions, which leads the trained eye to anticipate that these explosions happened with actual explosive matter in the device itself through some kind of supply chain attack, which is why Matthew Mavak on the Eyeopener Substack is calling this a cyber physical attack. Quoting directly from his Substack, therefore, the correct terminology for these attacks would be cyber physical attacks. These merge the digital and physical worlds using cyber means to cause tangible harm. I have a feeling we're going to hear this term more and more as wars escalate. In their coverage, 404 Media had a really good podcast interviewing somebody who has seriously taken a look at these kinds of batteries and battery fires, especially in the past. For those who may not remember, there have been quite a couple high-profile recalls, including Samsung Notes, of phones or even other devices such as hoverboards where their batteries would be prone to fires. Most people have heard of Teslas burning in fires. And again, the issue really for the lithium ion is more the fires rather than the explosion. So this led them at least to speculate that any kind of involvement would have required not just purely cyber means to, say, hack a battery management system, because I actually include another video here by Privacy and Tech Tips explaining that it is possible to hack a battery management system in a lithium ion battery to cause the thermal runaway that creates the fires. However, most speculation at this point points to the idea that there was some supply chain attack that involved planting explosives and somehow remotely detonating them through the pagers and walkie-talkies. This particular tactic has consequences, and I really want to highlight this post by Bunny Studios. Turning everyday gadgets into bombs is a bad idea. Quoting directly from the post, I think turning everyday gadgets into bombs is a bad idea. However, recent news coverage has been framing the weaponization of pagers and radios in the Middle East as something we do not need to concern ourselves with because we are safe. I respectfully disagree. Our militaries wear uniforms, and our weapons of war are clearly marked as such because our societies operate on trust. As long as we don't see uniformed soldiers marching through our streets, we can assume that the front lines of armed conflict are far from home. When enemies violate that trust, we call it terrorism, because we no longer feel safe around everyday people and objects. The reason we don't see exploding battery attacks more often is not because it's technically hard. It's because the erosion of public trust in everyday things isn't worth it. The current discourse around the potential reach of such explosive devices is clouded by the assumption that it's technically difficult to implement and thus unlikely to find its way to our front door. That assumption is wrong. It is both surprisingly easy to do and could be nearly impossible to detect. After I read about the attack, it took half an hour to combine fairly common supply chain knowledge with Wikipedia queries to propose the mechanism detailed below. So this post explains why technologically it is not difficult at all for any well-financed or highly organized and capable organization to really pull this off, but I especially want to quote the ending here. I fear that if we do not universally and swiftly condemn the practice of turning everyday gadgets into bombs, we risk legitimizing a military technology that can literally bring the front line of every conflict into your pocket, purse, or home. Fundamentally, I think it is critically important now more than ever that we are hard on what means we use to engage in wars and those of our allies and how those excesses are handled. For instance, it sounds like these attacks had a fair bit of collateral damage. There were children killed and innocents killed, and I think any situation where innocents, but especially children, are hurt in acts of war, they should be wholeheartedly investigated and wholeheartedly condemned. And the sad truth of the matter is that this whole cyber-physical war that's going on between nations will have consequences for people at home, whether or not we condone or condemn this particular attack. One of the things we've seen more and more is that the rise of censorship is directly linked to government's dire need to maintain control over the discussion, which will only get worse as wartime pressures escalate. Moving on to digital blunders. Autism Capital has a video of the first Trump Bitcoin transaction taking minutes to complete, and they're unsure if it even went through. This is deliciously ironic to me in some ways, because we had Trump and other candidates promoting at the latest Bitcoin Nashville conference that the federal government was going to buy Bitcoin with taxpayers' money to enrich the largest holders. So it is deliciously ironic that when Trump himself is doing this demonstration of how great Bitcoin is, it's not even working very well. Now, truthfully, this probably has to do with how Bitcoin works. It takes quite a long time for a Bitcoin transaction to confirm. For those people who aren't aware, a Bitcoin transaction is sent, but then it's not actually technically part of the system until it is, quote, confirmed many times. This means that the Bitcoin network mines a block that includes that transaction. That would be the first confirmation, but then you generally are encouraged to wait for many blocks so that you know your transaction is safely within the blockchain and not going to be overwritten by some intermediary fork. Given the speed in which they confirmed that the transaction went through, it's possible that this was not just an ordinary Bitcoin transaction, but was actually a different form of Bitcoin transaction using the Lightning Network. The Lightning Network operates entirely separately and differently on top of the Bitcoin network, and it itself also has its fair amount of usability challenges. In this scenario, it's highly likely that he was using a Lightning transaction, and there are many different reasons why it may have hiccuped in the moment for the demo. Payments going through aren't the only things crypto holders need to worry about. Tech Radar is reporting, crypto fans beware, hundreds of Android apps found using OCR to steal login details. Install these Android apps only if you want to lose your crypto stash. And this is a particularly novel use of OCR software, because many people are used to viruses or malware stealing information if it's in files, but if you have sensitive secrets in either screenshots or photographs in your camera roll, it is entirely possible for any app that is given access to those resources, inadvertently or not, will be able to use OCR, which turns text in images to straightforward text, to steal all kinds of information. This is one of many risks one has to worry about when malware is on your device. It is a great reminder to never install apps that you aren't absolutely sure about on your smartphone, which does include a whole lot of sensitive information on most people. Absolutely be careful to not have important secrets in your camera roll or on other aspects of your device, but definitely be careful of what apps you're installing, because that will very often be your first line of defense. Next up, we have TechCrunch reporting Bumble to leverage AI to help users with profile creation and conversations. So for those who aren't aware, Bumble is a dating or friendship making online application that is now using AI to create profiles. It is really ultimately quite tragic that we are seeing the elimination of people-to-people interactions online, and fundamentally, there are going to be these massive abstract AI filters between human beings. I think for some people, this could genuinely be an improvement. The go-to feedback a lot of people get when they have to write about themselves is, I have no idea what to write. And so maybe some gentle suggestions are highly welcome, but then you run into the inevitable scenario where it feels like everybody is just a cardboard cutout of the same theme. Now moving on to the solutions roundup. The first release candidate of FreeCAD 1.0 is out. This is fantastic news, actually. I have been following FreeCAD, which is a free and open source parametric 3D modeler, for quite some time. It allows you to build really precise 3D models, but it also includes many other features for many other forms of computer-aided design. FreeCAD is an excellent resource, and I am glad to see it is approaching its 1.0 version. In fact, I had been using it for so long that I had actually forgotten it hadn't actually reached a 1.0 release. It turns out I was more ahead of the curve than I thought. If you're interested in 3D modeling or 3D printing, I would highly recommend becoming familiar with FreeCAD, because it can definitely help you build very useful things. Next up, I have a post here from Aral Balkan's blog, encouraging individual sovereignty and a healthy commons. I mostly want to draw your attention to his post here, because while it does have excellent commentary on privacy and security, I really want to draw your attention to the last part here, where he talks about building the world you want to live in. Quoting from the post, in a talk I gave at the European Commission event in Rome recently, I told the audience that we must build the world we want to live in. For me, that is not a world owned and controlled by a handful of Silicon Valley oligarchs. It is a world with a healthy commons wherein we as a community collectively own and control those aspects of our existence that belong to us all, and where we as individuals individually own and control those aspects of our existence that belong to ourselves. Imagine a world where you and those you love have democratic agency, where we all enjoy basic welfare, rights, and freedoms befitting cyborg dignity. Imagine a sustainable world freed from the destructive short-term greed of capitalism, where we no longer reward sociopaths for finding ever more ruthless and destructive ways to accumulate wealth and power at the expense of everyone else. Imagine a free world removed from the feedback loop of manufactured fear, ubiquitous surveillance that has us spiraling deeper into a fresh vortex of fascism. Imagine a world where we grant ourselves the mercy of an intellectually rewarding existence, where we are free to explore the potential of our species among the stars. That is the world I wake up every day to work towards, not because it is charitable, not because I am a philanthropist, in fact, for no reason at all other than because it is the world I want to live in. Now, you may not have the same world in mind that Aral here does, but I would highly recommend adopting that mindset. If you spend all your time optimizing for living in the world we exist in, which is fundamentally necessary on some level, everybody has to do that to a certain degree, but then when you completely neglect to build things for the world you want to live in, suddenly you'll be encountering so many people who say, well, I can't do that, it's impossible. And so by building tools for the world you want to live in, i.e. by building software and tools that can help people do the things you want them to do, you can create the tools that then make that world a little bit more real for people who struggle to imagine it. I think for those of us who are interested in building a better world, whatever we believe that to be, we have to put the work into actually building things that make it tangibly real for others who have no concept for it. I believe this is of utmost importance in an age where so many people grow up with surveillance and censorship being entirely normalized. There are so many aspects to today's world that we take so many things for granted that don't have to be there. And so I find Aral, even though we may not agree eye to eye on every aspect of politics or economics, I absolutely think he has the right way of thinking about solutions, and that's why I highlighted his blog post here. Next up, we have a review for the Fairphone 5. He is notably not comparing the phone to, say, a regular flagship Android phone, but more his previous phone, the Ucatel WP5. Jumping straight to the chase, he answers answers the question, should I buy a Fairphone 5? He then writes, if you're looking for a good quality, mid-range, ethical phone, and you're in Europe, then I can certainly recommend it. Consider that it works at about 40 euros per year for 10 years, so it's not really fair to compare to other phones in the 700 euro range that will be declared obsolete by the manufacturer within 3 to 4 years. It's not as mind-blowing as the latest iPhone, it's not as cheap as the 70 euro no-brand phone from AliExpress, but I think it stands up on its own terms. Even before you consider that Fairphone are doing more than any other company to avoid child slavery and conflict minerals during the phone production, and that there are significant CO2 emissions associated with buying a new smartphone versus keeping the same one running for a decade. So far, I am very impressed with what Fairphone has managed to achieve here. Hopefully, they aren't too far away from world domination. Meanwhile, who is up for adding support in post-market OS for the old Ucatel WP5? So Fairphone is a very interesting option in the Android space for a independent produced phone that, as mentioned before, involves a more ethical source, but it's also not loaded up with as much Google, if I remember correctly. Next up, I have a tweet here from Keith, GnuKeith@x.com. The plan is simple. Security and privacy, open source and user first, usability and convenience, destroy big tech. This is a much shorter way of saying what I believe Aral was expressing in terms of building for the future you want, is that that is the plan. In my mind, anyone working on those goals is absolutely an ally of mine. I believe it is of utmost importance that we start really building up a digital environment where we use a lot of free and open source software and are not enabling tech giants to control, censor, and surveil people. Speaking of surveillance, I found a fascinating app here called Exodus for Android. Finds trackers embedded in all your apps. It's a relatively simple and straightforward app. You install it, it checks what apps you have installed against its own database, and it will tell you what trackers your apps are using. Some of these are relatively benign. For instance, some app makers want to know when their app crashes, but some of them are much more invasive. I would highly recommend for anyone trying to use Android as their daily device for a secure environment, definitely check out the Exodus app to try to see which apps are using what trackers, just so that you know what's worth using and what's not. I can say I was certainly surprised by some of the things I found using this app. Next up, we have another 1.0 project. Radical, which is a tool built on top of Git, is now reaching their first release candidate as well. Radical is a fascinating project where they're trying to build peer-to-peer, local-first code collaboration on top of Git. Git is a very useful tool, but there is this challenge for many people that if you're using Git entirely offline, how do you use it without being, say, censored by GitHub or some kind of central repository? Radical is a very interesting attempt at solving that problem. If you're somebody who's already well-versed in how to use Git and want to really push the boundaries on what you probably thought was possible with it, Radical is a fascinating project that I'm going to be paying more attention to as time goes on. For instance, I host my own CodeForge. You can self-host a GitHub equivalent software on your infrastructure. This is really important in situations where you wouldn't want that in the first place or you're worried about getting censored from it. Again, Radical is very interesting, but for many people, it may even seem as overkill. Lastly, but certainly not least, there is an announcement here announcing building a browser using Servo as a web engine. Yes, it seems like the browser space is absolutely being shaken up right now. I have mentioned in previous episodes that Servo is something that a browser could hypothetically be built on top of, and the Verso project is taking that on. The Servo browser engine is a very important part of a web browser that was built in some part by Mozilla, but then eventually abandoned. So if you're interested in the cutting edge of independent browser space right now, you've got this new project, Verso, and also consider that we covered in a previous episode, there is the Ladybird project. I think now is a fascinating time to learn how to build browsers if somebody is interested in really upping their game on their programming experience. Getting involved with these projects would be a great way to get on the ground floor of something very exciting. And we'll be back with more tech news after these messages.
We're all tired of big tech or even alt tech corporations deciding what creators can and can't talk about. We're tired of manipulative algorithms deciding what we should see. We're exhausted from switching from each new YouTube killer that comes along to just be more of the same. There has to be a better way. Thankfully, there is. PeerTube is the decentralized video hosting platform we've all been waiting for. Find an instance that's right for you, or even set up your own. PeerTube isn't just another YouTube alternative. It's a full-fledged cyber rebellion. As a small to medium creator, your own PeerTube instance is your first-class flagship to launch any multimedia project. PeerTube supports many amazing features, such as RSS feeds, so you can use the best podcast apps to watch or listen on the go. Fediverse support, so you can see comments beyond any single walled garden. Shared bandwidth, many people watching the same video at the same time share the load. Visit joinpeertube.org to learn how to run your own or find instances out there to join. Don't get left behind. Thank you for listening to this free preview of CyberFix. Please share and consider becoming a supporter to gain access to the entire broadcast. There are two ways to gain access to the entire show. One, the easiest method is to go to gabe.rocks/substack and purchase a paid subscription. Two, for the cyber rebels among you, go to gabe.rocks/monero and sign up for a subscription over the Fediverse. Links will be available in the description.